Hi, and this is the Physics High Podcast. A quick quiz. Do you A, want to be inspired by science communicators? B, want to learn all about science education? C, want guidance on your scientific journey? Well, how about D, all of the above? Today, my guest is Dr. Magdalena Kersting. Now, Magdalena is a physics educator, an educational researcher, and a science communicator, and currently is doing her postdoctoral research at the University of Oslo in Norway. Now, she has a great passion for Einsteinian physics, and in particular, general relativity. But really, what she's passionate about is communicating science, giving students a passion of science through the teaching of modern physics, and in particular, obviously, Einsteinian physics. Now, I had the pleasure of hearing her speak at the LIGO conference last year, and I got a taste of her passion, her infectious personality, that really is excited about educating and encouraging students to explore and chase their passion for science. Welcome, Magdalena.
Thanks so much for having me, and what a nice introduction that was.
From your website, from my readings of what you do, you really have two big things that you are dealing with at the same time. You have a passion for science education and educating others about the wonders of science, and obviously you have a real interest in Einsteinian physics. Could you tell the audience a little bit about what you do, and in particular, what you're currently doing with your postdoctoral research?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think before I dive into my current activities at the University of Oslo, I just give you a little bit of my background and idea of the path that has led me to where I'm currently. So by training, I'm a mathematical physicist. So I have studied physics and mathematics, and I've always been fascinated by abstract ideas and trying to understand the world and the universe, what holds the universe together. So studying physics and mathematics was just a no-brainer for me. But there's something about science and scientific questions that stretch your intellect and just, in a way, make you excited about wanting to learn more. And this excitement is something that I want to share with others. So, being a science educator and a science communicator really combines the best of two worlds, namely the world of science on one hand and the world of sharing this and helping others understand science as well, and just sharing not only science but sharing our excitement and just wanting to learn more and to grow and to be critical. And so this is for me what I'm doing. I'm involved in many different activities, but they all feel like they belong together and are just different aspects of the same passion of modern physics and of wanting to understand the world, really. And this is a little bit of my background. So what I'm currently doing and what I have been doing for the past years is that I'm a physics and science education researcher. And this means that I'm not only trying to educate others, but I'm actually doing research on improving instructional strategies. And this research, for example, entails developing learning resources. So I have developed a digital learning environment about Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity with my colleagues at the University of Oslo. And we used these learning resources to then do research on students' conceptions and teachers' struggles and teachers' opportunities when they try to bring these topics to the classroom. So it's really an activity, or my work entails developing learning resources, working with teachers like you, being in classrooms, interviewing students, analyzing video observations. In my latest project, we try to assess the quality of instructional practices in science classrooms. So we have video observation manuals. And so it's a lot of activities, really, but the idea is how can we improve science education?
To give our audience a taste of basically what you do, recently read two papers of yours, one about a more intuitive way of teaching how we know the existence of dark matter through the use of jelly if I might remember, which I thought were very interesting. I've got already the ingredients ready to do that experiment myself. And then you actually just published a paper just in the last few days too, particularly about misconceptions within time dilation. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. And I'm really excited about this paper. I think it got published like a week ago or a couple of days ago. And actually, I've written this with a colleague in Melbourne. So it's an Australian colleague. C and I have really tried to unpack what's going on when we talk about relativistic time dilation. And usually we teach students or we tell each other that time moves more slowly or more quickly, depending on how slowly or quickly you move yourself. But the way you're saying this often leads to misconceptions, and the general problem with relativity and trying to wrap your mind around relativity is that we don't really have an experience of relativistic phenomena, and it's super hard to visualize. How are you supposed to visualize time dilation? What does it mean for time for clocks to tick more slowly or more quickly, depending on how fast you move? And in this paper, we draw an important distinction between between observing and measuring a relativistic phenomenon. And this is really the idea, because if you say running clocks move slow, you don't actually see the clocks ticking more slowly. You don't see that. You would measure it if you were to measure it as an observer. And a critical notion here is the notion of an observer. And here's a problem with language, because like in everyday English, we talk about an observer and students and everyone knows what an observer is. But when we talk about an observer in special relativity or in relativity more generally, this has a really specific meaning, and we shouldn't confuse the act of observing with just seeing something and seeing as photons hitting your retina or like taking a picture of something. And we try to unpack this issue of observing and measuring, and we introduce an instructional strategy that hopefully will help teachers avoid this confusion and give students vocabulary and terminology to avoid this conceptual confusion.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the article, and I think that issue of language is a really important one. That's not just about observer and what an observer is. And I think it's other areas as well. Now, for our members of our audience, I'll publish a link for the article. I think we could talk for ages about this, but that's not the intent of this chat. But I'll put the link down the bottom, and it really encouraged, particularly for physics educators, that you have an opportunity to look at it. So, Magdalena, back to the subject at hand, which is really you. What got you into science? Was it a seminal moment in your life that just switched things on? Or was it something that you've always been passionate about? Tell us a little bit how you got into science.
That's a great question. And I think it actually was a seminal moment. And my story is probably one that many people can relate to, because as a child, I always loved watching the night sky. And it was this fascination with the stars and astronomy that really got me into science. But in the beginning, I didn't really relate like watching the sky and pondering the universe as a child to science and to physics specifically. And I remember, I think on my 12th birthday, maybe 13th, but I was 12 or 13 years old, and I got a birthday present, and it was this huge astronomy picture book, like an illustrated book of astronomy. And I absolutely loved this book, Paul. Like I would browse through it, and it had this, I was a little girl, and it felt like this book was huge, probably half the size of me, but it had these fantastic illustrations and photographs of stars and galaxies, and then little information text, and I would read through it, and I just completely fell in love, and I just knew this was something that I wanted to do. So it was really this birthday present that got me excited. And then from there, I just fell down the rabbit hole. I think I got Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time, and then I read Brian Greene and Michio Kaku and all those physicists and physics communicators. And so I think at the age of 12 or 13, I just had set my mind on becoming a physicist. And this is what I did a couple of years later. And this is what I'm still passionate about.
And that passion comes through. Now, talking about science education or science communication, I think we will both agree, and most people agree, the importance of having good science communication, not only for students, but at society at large too, I guess. How do you see your role in science communication? What's your views on the importance of science communication, whether it's close by or in a broader context in terms of society?
Of course, with my work, I want to have an educational impact. So it's one thing that I'm excited about these topics and I enjoy working on them and learning more about physics. But of course, I want to have an impact with my work. And I think science is awesome because science forces us to reflect on our actions, and it forces us to think critically about facts and about theories and ideas. So science gives us a playground to play with abstract ideas and to test hypotheses and to really become better thinkers in a way, and be able to navigate this world. I think at the end of the day, it's really about navigating this world and making sense of this world. And science is, of course, not our only playground, and it's not our only approach to understanding the world, but it's one that's a lot of fun and that really brings us a long way and allows us to explore a lot. So with science education and science communication, I hope I can contribute to helping people understand the world a little bit better, maybe become critical thinkers, and being able to just see how much fun it is to continue to grow and learn, not only as a student, but we are lifelong learners, right? And I hope that with my work that I really can help others see the beauty of science, see the excitement, and I don't really want to say become better human beings, but in a sense, yeah, become better human beings and just, keep learning, keep growing.
You mentioned the importance of critical thinking. We can probably see there's a lot of evidence of a reticence of people to be critical thinkers. You see it in the media particularly, and about the discussions on various social media. Not an easy question. But do you see...
We like difficult questions,
yeah, that's right.
Right.
That's right. So what do you see in terms of how do we get people to be encouraged to do critical thinking, to have more considered opinions, particularly, I mean, Jeff I spoke to last week, of course, and his particular concern is particularly in the field of climate science, where there isn't a lot of critical thinking shown, particularly within the, you know, society at large. Do you have any thoughts of how we could possibly combat that?
So, okay, I will step back from the climate science and just talk a little bit more generally about critical thinking and scientific literacy, because I think a lot of my ideas and what I'm going to say relates to different areas in science and different socio-scientific issues, of course. And yeah, it is indeed a difficult question how we can raise scientific literacy and how we can help people become critical thinkers in a way, but also become active and participate, because it's one it's one thing to be critical and it's easy to criticize, right? But it's a different thing to actually take actions and to participate in our society and try to make the world a better place. It sounds cliche, but how can we try to instill that in our students? And if I think about scientific literacy, because critical thinking is one part of scientific literacy, I usually think about three levels. And this reflects in my educational pathway as well. So first of all, we have knowledge in science. So knowing about scientific ideas and scientific theorems and scientific concepts, really. So this is our knowledge in science. But then there's knowledge about science. So you have to take a step back and reflect on the nature of science, the nature of scientific knowledge. How do we arrive at scientific ideas? What are scientific facts? How does our understanding get refined over time? And how can scientists claim one thing and then maybe realize they made a mistake? Or going back to general relativity, was Newton wrong in suggesting his theory of gravity? Was he wrong? Can we say he was wrong? Or did Einstein only extend the scope of applicability with his theory of gravity? So I think adding to knowledge in science, this important dimension of having knowledge about science and knowledge about the scientific process. And then there's a third aspect to it. And I think this is knowledge to use science and knowledge to participate in our society and really being brave enough to not only stay in academia or stay in the classroom or wherever you are, but actually trying to see how the different pieces fit together. And just this idea that we have highly specialized disciplines, there's science and then there are the humanities and arts, they are not separate. And I think this is something that we need to convey, and we need to show students and the society. Just because you have an interest in science doesn't mean that you cannot have an interest in the humanities or that you are not a creative and imaginative thinker. So I think fostering critical thinking and promoting scientific literacy starts with building awareness that we need knowledge in science, knowledge about science, and knowledge to use science. And getting back to my personal pathway, I feel like I have moved through these different stages, because as a student, I immersed myself in physics and mathematics, and I really learned this scientific knowledge and I loved it, and I didn't need anything else. It was just me and science, right? And you know that feeling. And then when I started my PhD in physics education, I was forced to learn about knowledge about science and gain knowledge about science. What is the scientific method? Is there such a thing as the scientific methods? And I feel like as a student, or as a physicist, really, I took so much for granted and I didn't reflect critically on that. And these are assumptions. Just being able to spell them out and being able to see that there are assumptions underlying physics and science more generally. So this is something that I really learned in my PhD. And now that I finished my PhD and I keep working on topics of science education and science communication, I really feel I'm starting to use my knowledge. I'm starting to use my knowledge in and about science to participate in society and to have impact and make a change. This was a really long answer too.
Excellent answer, I might add too. Very excellent answer. So we have students watching possibly who are thinking about science, further studies in science beyond the high school, maybe even a science career. What encouragement, what advice might you want to give to them?
So I think the most important thing is that you should do what you're excited about. And If you have this passion and this excitement for science, go with it. As long as you have fun and as long as you feel like learning science and learning more about science feels like playing, then you're on the right path. You have chosen the right path. And of course, I don't want to recruit every student into science. Like, I'm not saying this is the only thing you can do, but My advice would be science. Science is this huge playground. There's so much to play with. There's so much fun to have. And there you meet great people along the way. You get to travel. You get to exchange ideas. And being immersed in the scientific community is great. It's not only the science, but it's also about building connection, building a community, or being part of a community. So my advice... obviously, I'm biased, but I think my advice is if you're excited about science, go for it and just explore, read as much as you can. I'm an avid reader, and I think reading and just reading a little bit more than just the course material and falling down many rabbit holes, like fall down as many rabbit holes as you can. I remember the first time I took a course in general relativity, gosh, I think I spent my whole Christmas break reading books about general relativity, and you're left a little bit confused, maybe, bruised and confused, but glad all the same, because it's just, yeah, I'm not sure, like I'm rambling, but my advice is just be excited, be playful, read, find people that just fuel this excitement further, so that you surround yourself with people who have a similar passion, so that you don't feel alone, but that you can really see that you're part of a community, which is so important these days. Like, what I'm in lockdown, right? Like, what keeps me going is that I know there are you in Sydney, and I have colleagues, like-minded friends all over the world. So find the right people, surround yourself with the right people, the right colleagues, and have fun with it.
Your answer is surprisingly similar to Jeff Wiener's answer, and it actually just is being a good scientist that builds our reliability in terms of our argument here. Really is about totally finding your passion and going down that rabbit hole and keeping asking questions and keep exploring, mm-hmm. and that's just an intrinsic benefit. You just enjoy the process of constantly learning. Yes, it's hard sometimes. Yes, it's challenging. General relativity, I still bends my mind, pardon the pun, but the reality is that that's actually what is fascinating about it. It's far more exciting than, I mean, Newton's laws are important, but there is something exciting about modern physics that drives you to want to know more, to understand it better and so forth. So I totally agree with you. My last question is an opportunity for you to teach something that you are currently really passionate about. So think of a topic, and it doesn't necessarily have to be physics education content, but if someone said something in mixed company, you go, I want to share something with you, what would that be?
Okay, that would be probably embodied cognition, which is only partly related to science, but it's one of my current research interests. And I'm briefly giving you an idea of what embodied cognition is, and then showing you how I've used this in my research to understand how students make sense of abstract learning domains, such as general relativity. And I think before I start delving into embodied cognition, just to help listeners of yours get an idea of what science education research entails. Science education research is not only science. We do research about scientific learning processes or how learners learn science, but the methods we use are not necessarily scientific in the strict sense, because people are messy, right? It's easy to study the world with the laws of physics, and there are laws and there's mathematics, but you're a teacher, Paul. You know, learning cannot be studied in this rigorous way. People are messy, and depending on the time of day or the temperature or like your general mood, and if you've had your first coffee in the morning, because for me it's morning, right? And I need my coffee to keep going. So studying humans is generally messy and difficult, and this is why we need different methods. And these methods come from the social sciences, they come from psychology, they come from neuroscience and cognitive science. And this brings me back to embodied cognition, because embodied cognition is a family of theories in psychology and cognitive sciences and cognitive linguistics that basically tell you that we cannot understand learning and we cannot understand human cognition without taking the body into account. And this is something most people think, if they hear the word cognition, learning, they think it's happening in our brains, right? There's our mind and our body has nothing to do with it. But interestingly, just the fact that we have human bodies and that we perceive the world through our senses and that our cognitive and conceptual systems really build on this biological basis and this embodied basis influences the way we think and influences the way we make sense of the world. So this is, in a nutshell, embodied cognition. And ideas of embodied cognition have had a long philosophical history. I'm not going into that. But what is exciting about it is that it allows me to unpack learning processes in learning domains that are highly abstract. And this is general relativity, for example, because in general relativity, we talk about four-dimensional curved spacetimes. Can you visualize four dimensions, Paul? It's super difficult, right? It's challenging. Nope. And even three dimensions can be difficult, trying to make sense of three-dimensional geometry. And in my research, I have found out, or together with my colleagues, you never do research alone, we have found out that there is really a conceptual conflict between your embodied understanding of gravity and your embodied understanding of how you navigate our world. This on one hand, and then on the other hand, Einstein's abstract description, or the abstract description of general relativity, describing gravity not as a force in the classical sense, but as the curvature of four-dimensional space-time. And making sense of this idea, it's one thing to have abstract equations, but how do you understand this? And there's a conceptual conflict between our embodied understanding and our abstract understanding. And this is something that I have explored in my research, and I continue to explore how we can use perspective of embodied cognition to help learners make sense of science, to help learners make sense of abstract ideas. And you see, this relates to science, but it's not really part of science. And if I was at a party, I would probably not be the cool girl, because I would talk about philosophy and cognitive science and embodied cognition. But this is something that I have a keen interest in these days.
Is there a future paper in this?
Oh, I hope there are future proposal and grants and fellowships in it. So yeah, there are papers in the making. There are actually one paper that I can share with you, and maybe you want to put it on your homepage as well, is a paper that we published probably already 3 years ago, in which we look at the famous rubber sheet analogy. Like, you have this, how can we understand or visualize Albert Einstein's ideas? Well, four-dimensional curved space-time is like a stretched rubber sheet, and you put bowling balls and marbles onto it. And I analyzed this this model or this analogy, and I used our students in Norway that we had worked with, and I analyzed this this analogy from an embodied cognition perspective to give just instructional ideas or ideas on how you can improve instructional strategies in general relativity. So yeah, there has been some research going on, and I hope there will be a lot more in the next months and years.
Excellent.
Well, thank you so much, Magdalena, for your time. I think we really got a sense of your passion for physics education. I really appreciate you having a chat with me.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
I hope to have an opportunity to speak with you again.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please remember to subscribe to get notifications of upcoming interviews. And you can find me on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter at Physics High. My name is Paul from Physics High. Till next time.